material contributions or whatever. But if you're interested in pursuing Fritz Kramer or anything else about the Mabe Russell research, that is the place to go. That again from One Step Beyond from Sunday, June 18th of 1989. Now, I was never to get around to distributing or having Paul distribute Mabe Russell Research Center literature with Archives on Audio mailings because the following took place. In August of 1989, and bear in mind I had contributed $500 to the Mabe Russell Center and helped out with the Sheehan fundraiser and was promoting it. In August of 1989, I received a call from Mr. Roy Tuckman of KPFK-FM, who airs my programs down on KPFK in Los Angeles. And Roy said that there was going to be a fundraiser for the Mabe Russell Research Center under the auspices of KPFK, and that John Judge and yours truly were going to be speakers. And I was offered the opportunity, I was told that I would be paid $200 and that all of my expenses would be paid in Los Angeles. So I agreed to do this. I called Roy back a few days later, actually I think it was about a week later, to get more specific information about this, and I was informed then that it was only going to be John Judge. Apparently somehow John Judge had managed to maneuver me out of the talk, and at that point I wrote John Judge off. I determined I wanted nothing more to do with the guy. I'd given him $500 for the center, helped promote the Dan Sheehan fundraiser, contributing materially to the success of that event, had agreed to distribute Mabe Russell Research Center information along with Archives on Audio mailings. I had offered the guy a position of the position of co-host, and he turned right around and maneuvered me out of $200 and an expense-paid trip to Los Angeles. Although I certainly could withstand the monetary loss, it was really the principle of the thing. And at that point, I wrote John Judge off. I had still not spoken out against him and publicly, and I continued to maintain silence despite the fact that at that point I absolutely crossed the guy off. Now, in October of 1989, as you've heard, the majority of the volunteers quit. You've heard, oh, by the way, I should add that when I saw John Judge for the last time, which was at the memorial service in October of 1989 on the first anniversary of May's passing, John Judge told me that the reason why I'd been excluded from the function was because the general manager of KPFK, a gentleman named Alan Fong, didn't want John and I appearing on the same venue. And that turned out not to be true. That was October of 89, and that was the last time I ever saw John Judge. Now, in October of 89, as you've heard, most of the volunteers quit for reasons that you have already heard, and I've let them speak for themselves. As mentioned, Tom Davis and Will Robinson removed the core of May's files from the Mabe Russell Research Center. John then changed the locks on that center. Also, something very interesting happened with the aforementioned picnic on the grassy knoll. This was a function that John Judge had planned in which a number of researchers were to gather in order to celebrate or observe John F. Kennedy's assassination. It was to be on November 22nd, 1989. Among the people whose names were on it was yours truly. And more interestingly to me, PICNIC was an acronym. It stood for Public P period, I period, C period, N period, I period, C period. Public information creates new intelligence circles. Now, as I mentioned earlier in one of the talks with the volunteers, one technique the intelligence community has, and one of the things they do, is they will occasionally put things out in the open, although only in such a way as to inform those who know how to read between the lines. It's really a way of kind of mocking their enemies. I don't know that this is, again, an X factor, but when I saw the public information creates new intelligence circles, that's one of the thoughts that came to mind. That may not be the case, and I fully acknowledge that for the record, but on the other hand, it may be the case, and it's one of the things that made me uneasy. At that point, I spoke out, mentioned that many of the volunteers had quit, that as yet it had not been incorporated, and talked about the picnic on the grassy knoll, but I did not mention the public information creates new intelligence circles factor. I didn't mention that that at least hinted of a possible intelligence involvement here, and again, I have always had the suspicion that the Mabe Russell Center may have been a vacuum cleaner operation. That may not have been the case. I fully acknowledge that for the record, but there are definite indications that it may have been. Finally, when December of 1989 came along, when John Judge, as you've heard, entered into open opposition of the wishes of the Brussel family, when Cayenne's husband received that anti-Semitic death threat, when her car was discovered to have been vandalized the following morning, with this strange woman, Wendy, who, again, I never met, I wouldn't know her if I passed her on the street, with everything that you've already heard, I went on the air formally attacking the center. Well, but really, attack is not the right word, but I warned people that I thought there were some very serious things going on. And again, I do not know precisely what the relationship was between the Constitutional Patriots and John Judge. That's an X factor. But some of the volunteers felt that, in their opinion, there were hints of anti-Semitism on John's part. And with the identity preachers tolerated by that group, and with Cayenne getting an anti-Semitic death threat, it was an X factor in my decision to speak out against the Mae Brussel Center, or at least against what was going on. On December 4th of 1989, I said the following on my For the Record program on KKUP, the first actual speaking out against the center proper that I did. Let's listen to that talk. Well, basically, I have some things to talk about which are not going to be easy for me to talk about. Certainly very disturbing. However, I feel that I have an obligation with a capital O to talk about them. People who have been listening to this station for some time are familiar with the work of the late Mae Brussel, whose work was aired here for a number of years. Mae died under somewhat ambiguous circumstances of cancer. Many people, myself included, suspect that cancer may have been induced. There has been a long-standing way for our national security establishment to, or there have been long-standing ways developed since 1954, for our national security establishment to eliminate people via cancer, and Mae was receiving death threats, which is why she left the air here at KKUP. And she was also having illicit entries into her home at the time. People, parties unknown, were coming into her home and leaving word, via little things moved around and so forth, that they were there. Mae died of cancer shortly after being driven off the air. And her work, there was a lot of debate about what to do with her work. And initially, Mae was going to break up the collection into about five or six different pieces and distribute it to a number of her trusted associates. At that point, John Judge, who had known Mae for quite some time, came in and presented her with a proposal to place all of her research under basically John's care. Basically, it was placed under his usage, although not actually given to him. And basically, this was to be set up as a research center. It was to be set up as a vehicle for promoting Mae Brussel's research and for opening up her files and her books, as well as promoting her tapes, to researchers who wanted to use it. And this was to be done under John's supervision, although the books were actually kept by the Brussel family. Well, basically, to make a very long story very short, I personally don't have that much to do with the center. I help promote a fundraising function for them, and made a donation myself. Some people that have become aware of May's work through my own have donated their efforts. But to make a very long story very short, a lot of things have gone wrong over there. All of the volunteers quit in protest over John's behavior. There may be other people working there now, I can't say for sure. Many people, myself included, have been alienated from the station by John's behavior in a variety of different ways. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not accusing John of criminal behavior, but I will state for the record, and my understanding is a lot of other people will also, but I will state in legal format if necessary, that John has lied to me personally on several occasions about a number of very important things, and apparently this has happened with a lot of other people as well. The problem with lying is that, although it is a part of life, it is a very poor basis for any professional or personal relationship. There's the story of the boy who cried wolf, and once someone has a proven history of lying, and I state for the record that John has lied to me personally about a number of important things in the past, it makes it impossible for a pragmatic person to take that person's word at face value, even if they do and begin hollering wolf about a real wolf. The situation at the May Brussels Center has disintegrated. The volunteers have basically quit. And the single most ominous thing to me, aside from the disappointment of having someone who was meant to work in concert with May's successors basically turning up in a questionable context and operating, and at least towards me and apparently quite a few other people as well, judging from the fact that the volunteers quit, operating in an antagonistic framework. The thing that is scary to me is that in the background, in the milieu of the May Brussels Research Center and John Judge, there are a lot of people who have evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of exactly the people that May spent her time researching. We have evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Western Goals, a private intelligence foundation run by the late Larry McDonald, who died in KL007, and his wife Catherine then picked up his work after he was finished for a while. There are a lot of people. We have evidentiary tributaries going in the direction of the Aryan Nation, literally. The problem with this is that some of these connections may very well be innocent. Certainly, for the record, everyone professes innocence in all matters, and quite possibly, well, I don't think the chances are all that good, but quite possibly, they're right. But the problem is that the lying is really the fly in the ointment with this whole thing, because with elements like the Aryan Nations and Western Goals turning up in various ways in the background of many of the people in John's milieu, it raises questions. There is a type of intelligence operation known as a vacuum cleaner operation, which is exactly what the name implies. It's an operation in which basically a baited trap is set up so that people can, for example, people will write into a given foundation or something like that in order to secure something, and basically the names are then kept on file. It's a way of securing information. My fear is, and I want to put it exactly that way, my fear is that the May Brussels Research Center may in fact be such an operation. Certainly there are some unpleasantly looking elements turning up in, there are unpleasant looking elements turning up in the backgrounds of a lot of the people associated with John's milieu over there with the center. And there is very disturbing behavior. And the real, as I say, the real monkey wrench in the whole works is the lying. And it pains me to have to say this. This is not an easy thing for me to do. I'm sure listeners can detect the emotion in my voice. And it is a very difficult thing for me to do. But I made some professional differences between John and myself clear on sister station KFJC. We just don't see eye to eye professionally, which in and of itself is neither here nor there under the circumstances. I've avoided trying to say anything about this. In fact, I did the best I could to distance myself from things at the center when it became clear to me that the situation was not to my liking. However, basically John has projected himself in various ways into some of my professional relationships. My work has aired on a number of other stations. And because of that, I really felt compelled to speak out. I feel compelled to tell you that this situation has ominous indications of a possible military intelligence operation, and please note the use of the word possible. Also note that it need not be possible. No one can say for sure, and I sure as hell hope to God I'm wrong about it, because it's a very disturbing thing, and that would make it a really evil thing. But I myself would... I feel compelled to speak out about it because I think there are ominous indications that this may be the case. And the thing which has compelled me to speak out this evening is that I am afraid, well, basically large elements, significant elements at the so-called May Brussels Research Center, including John Judge, have entered into open opposition to the wishes of the Brussels family with regard to important matters of policy with the center. Again, John Judge and important elements at the station have entered into open opposition with the wishes of the Brussels family on important matters of policy. And I fear for the lives of certain people or for their safety. I think it's possible people might get hurt. And beyond that, if, and this is a capital if, with a capital I, my fears concerning this as a possible vacuum cleaner operation are true, then the lives and well-being of the people who have in good faith written into the center and donated money and effort and so forth Well, they are in danger, too. And, however, I feel that having studied this material for about 15 years, having been on the air for 10-plus, I have a pretty good idea what I'm looking at in this field at this point, and I think there are ominous indications that this may be true. And it is certainly a matter of public record, or is, from now on. And I should say that I have not been sanctioned by any one connection. You know, I have not been sanctioned to say this. I'm acting on my own. But I fear for the safety of people perhaps involved with this operation, and John Judge and significant elements at the center have entered into a state of open opposition to the wishes of the Brussels family on important matters of policy. And my fear is that what we're looking at is some kind of an operation, and again, I hope I'm wrong. And the monkey wrench is, again, like with the boy who cried wolf, John's lack of candor, and that's the most delicate way I could put it, has simply made it impossible for me to disregard the worst possibilities of the situation under the circumstances. And I base my actions in a legal sense on the Nuremberg principle of international law. My feeling is, as I thought about it, that there's maybe a 2-to-1 chance here, I think, something like that, and I hope I'm wrong. I may be wrong, but I think there's a strong possibility anyway. You can't put a number on it, but I think there's a strong possibility that this may be some kind of an operation. And because of that, I feel that I have a responsibility as someone who is licensed to use the radio spectrum, the electronic spectrum, which is a public resource, that in accordance with the Nuremberg principles, I must speak out to warn of the possibility. To warn of the possibility. I hope I'm wrong. Perhaps I'm wrong. I'm afraid I'm right. I am literally afraid I'm right. And in the event of any possible legal proceedings or whatever, I basically cite my warnings and my on-air speculation on the Nuremberg statutes of international law. And I hope I'm wrong, and I want to say that there really aren't good precedents for this sort of thing. For those of you who find this disturbing, believe me, I find it at least as disturbing as you do. More so, really, because I'm afraid for people's safety under the circumstances. There appear to be some very unsavory things going on over there. And there are no legal precedents for this sort of thing. The only legal precedent, or the only legal point of reference that I can think of, is the Nuremberg principle, and it is upon that that I am acting this evening, and I stand very strongly on what I am saying. I may be wrong, but I'm afraid I'm right, and the indications certainly point in that direction. And if the party or parties involved with the situation find this displeasing, and I'm sure this doesn't set them to doing the varsity rag, it doesn't do it to me either, well, the lack of candor and the double dealing in certain respects are their burden to bear, not mine. So I certainly hope I'm wrong. I'm afraid I'm right, but I feel absolutely compelled to speak out that I think this is a distinct possibility, and I think we have to be careful and find out more. Food for thought and grounds for further research, as I like to say. And again, I know this is disturbing, but I've never been down this road before myself, and I feel, under the circumstances, that human welfare and the continuance of human life is the dominant consideration. If, in fact, my worst fears are realized here, and certainly there are unsavory and undesirable things going on there, then by steering people into the May Brussels Center, I would, in effect, become an accessory to mass murder, and that's certainly not something I'm doing here. And I want to make it very clear that I am not accusing anyone of any crimes. But I have been lied to repeatedly by John Judge over there, and apparently that is one of the reasons why all the volunteers quit, too. Apparently mine is not a unique experience, and I will state that. I will at least state my own experience for the record. And this is a disturbing thing to have to do, but I think I pretty much said what I've had to say. I'm acting out of fear for people's safety and quite possibly my own. I think that this is indeed food for thought and grounds for further research, and I would caution people to be very careful under the circumstances. And I certainly hope that my fears are unfounded, but if nothing else, this is a lesson in human honesty and why it is terribly important not to lie. Lies are a part of life, but they're a poor basis for any professional or personal relationship. And in this business, they have a significance, they're fraught with a significance, which they're not necessarily fraught with in other situations. So that's basically what I have to say. I'm going to put on... And that, once again, was from KKUP on Monday, December 4th, of 1989. Now, this whole business, that'll give you a pretty good idea of what transpired between myself and John Judge. I will simply note again what's in Vankin's book here. He dismisses all of the funky doings on the part of John Judge and some of the things that I had to say about him. Speaking of yours truly, Vankin writes, he makes a series of charges against Judge which frankly sound like flights of fancy and in any case are unconfirmable and therefore unprintable. Well, some of the suspicions I expressed, and I never expressed any more than suspicions, are unconfirmable, but the reality, or what he puts, he writes, whatever the objective reality of the May Brussels Research Center, well, the objective reality could have been very easily determined had Vankin done some fieldwork, which he obviously did not do for whatever reason. He completely exonerates John Judge of wrongdoing in connection with the center, writing as follows. He collected thousands somewhere in the mid-five figures, then a series of personal conflicts and health problems drove him back to the East Coast. The center collapsed to be resurrected by Davis and some associates as the May Russell Library in Seaside, California. There was a string of problems with the center, one of them Judge's refusal to open it to the public. And it goes on to blame yours truly in large measure for this. As I said, the only connection I had with that was with John Judge was to offer him a position of co-host to contribute to the May Brussels Research Center fundraiser by promoting it. I gave him $500, promoted his talks and the May Brussels Center. That was the extent of my involvement. I would note here, too, that Vankin writes, Davis says he personally implored Emory, to whom the May Brussels Research Center will always be, quote, so-called, unquote, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emory burst. Well, you just heard me burst, quote, unquote. I would add here that at no point did I consult with Tom Davis about this, about, quote, attacking the May Brussels Center. Tom had always felt that this was nothing but a personality conflict, still apparently does, and you've now had a chance to determine the objective reality for yourself. Only three substantive conversations have taken place between Tom Davis and myself since May's passing. In late November of 1988, I met with Tom Davis at the Curry Village Restaurant on Saratoga Sunnyvale Road in Cupertino, and I also met with him in the summer of 1989, and I had dinner with him following the memorial service on the first anniversary of May's passing in October of 1989. Those are the only substantive conversations that have taken place between Tom Davis and yours truly since the May's passing. And at each of those meetings, precisely because of the ominous indications about what was going on, I had counsel present, a good friend of mine who not only drove me to these gatherings, because as I said, I no longer drive after having been poisoned in 1986, but he's not only a good friend and drove me to these, but one of the details apparently overlooked by Tom Davis is he also was my attorney and was present at every one of the meetings that took place between Tom Davis and myself, and at no point did I consult with him about speaking out against the center. I acted on my own, and this, too, is complete fiction. I did what I did because I felt there was an awful lot of strange thing. There were a lot of strange things going on, and in particular, I felt Cayenne may very well have been in danger, and a lot of the people there were scared. A lot of them were afraid of what would happen, and I felt it was time to move. I'm going to play you a tape of what I said, my eulogy, over May Brussels' grave. Cayenne had requested that everyone who was close to May have something to say at the funeral. I was rent to the marrow at the time, and I really couldn't think of what to say, so I decided to just sort of let it flow when the time came. And the following eulogy, basically a poem, came to me almost literally spontaneously. I came to understand how the ancient Greeks could have viewed artistic inspiration as the product of a spirit called the muse, who supposedly whispered in the ears of artists. Don't worry, I'm not going New Age or spiritual on you, but in the state of grief that I was in at May's funeral, I did basically have the following words flow into me. I basically put them together in a space of maybe 2, 3, 4 minutes, and I'm going to play you my eulogy over May Brussels' grave at her funeral. The sound quality is very poor. This is from a videotape, and at one point an airplane flies over, so not all of my words are intelligible, but it will help you understand my pledge to May and why I felt I had to speak out. These are the words that I had to say over May's grave.
My name is David Emery, and I've put Mays programs on up in the South Bay for almost 10 years now, and with mixed feelings, my work was responsible for getting her program on KPFK in Los Angeles, which elicited the death threats, which I'm sure you all know about or you can find out about. I wonder to what extent I might have been responsible for bringing May to this situation. I'd always wondered when Cayenne said that she wanted people who were close to her to speak over May's grave. I depicted the scene, and as anyone who knows me knows all too well, I usually have no problem finding words. We swim, birds fly, and I talk. But as I stand here, I couldn't think of what to say. But I guess what it comes down to is I cannot believe that they're laying you into the earth. Life, as the earth nourishes each one of us, the food she brings forth, and as she supports us now as we stand upon her bosom, I feel a great sense of loss and loneliness. That's why I wanted to speak after I heard what Hal said. All I can say, lady, is I'm going to need the guidance of your spirit. Just as you nourished me when I went to your house, you taught me how to prepare good food and what to eat and what not to eat. I haven't eaten meat in a month, May. So I'm going to need you. I'm going to need your spirit to nourish me in the future. And I will need the knowledge you gave me to nourish my body so that my arm may wield the sword of truth which you placed in my hand with maximum effect. When I have to use that sword and strike with deadly accuracy, please let my aim be true. And when the time comes for me to sheath that sword in a spirit of mercy, I will need you more than ever then, so that I will not water the earth with the blood of the innocent. And hopefully, in a time of peace, your support will tell me, should I not join you beneath the soil, to beat that sword into a plowshare, so that as I now water the earth with my tears, I can till it to bring forth nourishment for others. God bless you, my holy spiritual mother. Rest in peace, because I promise you Fritz Kramer won't.
And that's what I had to say over May's grave. And with all of the funky doings going on, I decided it was time to take the sword of truth out of its scabbard and to strike. Well, I struck, and I'm glad I did. Sic Semper Tyrannis, baby. Sic Semper Tyrannis. One of the things that I find most grotesque about the Vanguard book is how it makes sport of other people's suffering. There's a brief reference to my eulogy over May's grave. In the book, on page 86, we find the following. May Brussel, 66 years old, died on October 3rd, 1988, of cancer. At her gravesite, David Emery, one of many who look on Brussel as a hero of the 20th century, delivered a vengeful eulogy laden with vows to track down her murderers. Well, anyone who heard just vengeance, and there was actually no vengeance, although I could understand how someone not particularly intelligent or well-educated might interpret it that way. What you heard there was obviously grief, love, resolve, and militancy to carry on the work. What I said about Fritz Kramer, I said, rest in peace, my words over May's grave, rest in peace, my holy spiritual mother, Fritz Kramer won't. I'm not about to try and track down Fritz Kramer, because that would literally be suicidal. By the way, Fritz Kramer was the chief, the plans officer for the United States Army from 1949 through 70. Henry Kissinger, among others, is his protege. May believed, and I'm inclined to agree with her, that Fritz Kramer may very well be the same Fritz Kramer who served as chief of staff of the 6th SS Panzer Army during World War II. He's a very powerful man, literally untouchable, and I'm no more going to try and track down Fritz Kramer than I'm going to try and throw rocks at the moon. He's literally untouchable, and I want as much distance between myself and Fritz Kramer as possible. What I was saying was basically, rest in peace, May. Fritz Kramer won't when his time comes. And the sword in question was, as you hear, go back and play the tape for yourselves. I'm obviously not going to replay it because we're running all well over time now. That was the sword of truth. It was a metaphor. It wasn't talking about a real sword with a real metal blade or really shedding blood. You might think that a budding literati like Vanken would have been able to distinguish that, but of course, it should be said that Jonathan Vanken was not present at May's funeral. John Whalen was present at May's funeral, And that, no doubt, is where this particular gem comes from. John Whalen does the Daily Grind column for the San Jose Metro, and he gets a big credit from Jonathan Vankin. And Vankin writes in the introductory, the acknowledgments to his book, of all the people who helped with my research, my colleague John Whalen, media columnist as Metro, deserves top billing. Well, he gets top billing, all right. Name up in lights. What kind of lights? Moonlights, as it were, so to speak, under the circumstances. In conclusion, and again, that's one of the things that I find grotesque about the book, it makes sport of what were deeply wounding and very poignant experiences. My eulogy over May's grave was as poignant an experience as I've ever had in my life, and I do not enjoy having some front-running yuppie pantyways to make fun of it. This whole experience was deeply wounding and very frightening to all the people involved, and it is not a subject for humor. Now, in conclusion, there are some interesting questions to be asked. John Judge remains an X factor, and so does Jonathan Vankin, frankly, so far as I'm concerned. A few remarks that should be said. I always have been convinced that May was murdered. On July 4th, 1986, in the first place, she was receiving death threats shortly before she died. On July 4th, 1986, on the centennial anniversary of the Statue of Liberty, there was a huge celebration. I visited May, and I told her to her face that I felt that some of the company she was keeping was unsavory, and that if she wasn't more careful, that she would get one of these national security cancers she was always talking about. There were no witnesses to this, but this was 2 years before May died, and 2 years later she died in the way I had predicted. In September of 1987, following some maneuvering to reduce May's programming time on sister station KKUP-FM, I expressed to KKUP general manager, he was not the general manager then, he is now, Al Calamay, that I was afraid this may be an attempt to drive May off the air and then kill her with cancer. I ruminated about that, and General Manager Al Calamay of KKUP can bear witness to that. One of the questions I have, and I want to emphasize this is not a statement I'm making, but a question I have, is that if May was killed, and I suspect she was, and in fact I told her 2 years, to the 2 years before she lay mortally ill with cancer, that I thought she was going to get it, and she got it. Whether or not it was given to her, I don't know. But they always work up someone to take your place if you're going to get hit. Behind every JFK, there's an LBJ, and we're going to take time to change the tapes here. And again, I wonder. There's certainly a lot of very strange things about John Judge, a male feminist who has women scrubbing the bathroom. There were a lot of weird people connected with the center. One person who had some connections with the center was being pursued by author Maury Terry of The Ultimate Evil in connection with the Arliss Perry killing. That was a killing, according to Maury Terry, committed by the Process Umbrella Cult, an apparently national security-related cult involving, among other things, the Son of Sam killing, probably the Manson killings. And I talked about that in a miscellaneous archive show called The Ultimate Evil, Satanism, Mind Control, and the U.S. National Security Establishment. So there were a lot of very strange people in some way associated with the center. John was keeping some strange company and doing some very strange things. There are certainly indications he may not be what he says he is. And one of the things I've always wondered, whether John was perhaps May's backup. That may not be the case. This may all be coincidence. There are bigger coincidences in life. And I fully acknowledge that possibility for the record, but it's certainly a question I have, and I think it's a question that needs to be asked under the circumstances. And it's also interesting to note that in this article that I read earlier, Roger Steffens' article, he observes, quote, and again this is from The Beat, Volume 10, Number 6, "But to state as fact Judge's groundless and cockeyed assertions does such a disservice to those endeavoring to find the truth that if the CIA deliberately planted Judge to discredit its critics, they couldn't have done a more perfect and cynical job." Well, that may not be the case. He may just be a sloppy researcher, and I fully acknowledge that possibility for the record. But it is an interesting question. Not a statement I'm making, but it is a question I'm asking. It's also more than a little interesting that we find John Judge being completely exonerated in a book that was published by Paragon House, again owned by the Unification Church, an organization inextricably linked with the American right, the intelligence community, and international fascism. And again, I have no way of knowing Jonathan Vankin's possible culpability in this. He did, according to Ted Rubenstein, know the Paragon House was Moon, but that may be an innocent connection, and I fully acknowledge the possibility for the record. Another interesting connection, it may not be significant, but then again it might be. Also, it's worth observing in light of the suspicions on the part of some people, and it's a question I hold open, that John might be under mind control, that we also find John Judge being exonerated and covered, in essence, in a book, the publisher of which is one of the top intelligence-connected mind control cults in the world. I would also note an interesting connection going back to this announcement vis-a-vis the Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association, Constitutional Patriots Association. And again, I have no way of assessing the relative guilt or innocence of any individual. Maybe most of them are just fine folks, but obviously some of them are into identity Christianity and similar activities, calling themselves, quote, Hitler's Last Battalion. This is, as I said, one of the X factors vis-a-vis John Judge. It did influence my opinion to my desire to, not desire, but my decision to speak out against the activities going on that you heard. Once again, research credit on this goes to Sarah Diamond, and this is from the announcement that I read before. The Constitutional Patriots Association presents the 4th Annual Champions of Freedom Rally. In addition to the band Legacy and Pastor Pete Peters, both of whom at least apparently sympathetic to identity Christianity, we find the following person. Another speaker at this gathering is Pastor Everett Sylvan, spelled S-I-L-E-V-E-N, described as a candidate for governor of Nebraska and Unregistered Churches Association. Interestingly enough, Everett Sylvan represents a link between the tax protest movement and the Unification Church. Returning once again to Spiritual Warfare by Sarah Diamond, South End Press, copyright 1989, soft cover, we read, aside from Balsinger's determination to network the Christian right with extremist emigre, another curious coalition emerged in 1984. That was the year that the Unification Church's Reverend Sun Myung Moon began an 18-month prison sentence for conspiracy to file false tax returns, to obstruct justice, and to commit perjury. But what appeared to be a setback for the Moon organization turned out to be a public relations windfall, as the Moonies organized an expensive campaign to win sympathy for Moon as a, quote, persecuted, unquote, religious leader. In May of 1985, New York Unification leader Ken Sudo, S-U-D-O, told fellow Mooney leaders, quote, Father went to Danbury Prison as the leader of the Unification Church, but when he comes out, he must be the leader of the free world. Before and after Moon was released from prison in 1985, he got out early on good behavior. The Moonies published a series of full-page ads in leading newspapers claiming that Moon had been falsely charged and selectively punished. The Moonies persuaded prominent religious groups to sign the ads, including the National Council of Churches, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the National Association of Evangelicals, and the ACLU, calling on the Supreme Court to review the case. The, quote, Moon as Martyr, unquote, campaign successfully obscured the fact that Moon was convicted not for tax evasion per se, but on charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and perjury. Moon and co-defendant Takuro Kamiyama, K-A-M-I-Y-A-M-A, were indicted and convicted on 13 counts. Also, while Moon was in prison, his followers spent an estimated $4.5 to $10 million to send 300,000 pastors an informational package, including copies of The Divine Principle, Moon's theological opus, in which he asserts that Christ will return to earth as a Korean. The Moonies' public relations drive spawned the creation of the Coalition for Religious Freedom in 1984. Though headed by fundamentalist ministers, the organization has been financed primarily by the Unification Church, which gave an initial donation of $500,000. Skipping down, to rally, quote, born-again, unquote, support for the religious freedom cause, the CRF focused not only on Moon's plight, but also on the case of Reverend Everett Sylvan, whose church school in Nebraska was in trouble with state authorities, see Chapter 3, and a slew of cases in which obstinate, quote, independent, unquote, churches were battling the bureaucracy over health and safety codes, zoning licenses, building permits, and tax imbroglios. So it may not have any significance at all. As I say, there are coincidences in life, and this perhaps may be one of them. Reverend Moon touches an awful lot of bases and washes upon many shores. And as I said, this Constitutional Patriots Association is one of the X factors vis-a-vis John Judge, but it certainly is interesting and possibly significant that we see Reverend Everett Sylvan with Constitutional Patriots and the Unification Church. Perhaps just a coincidence, and I fully acknowledge that, but may be significant. Another thing which may be significant, but it may very well be coincidental, at my interview with Jonathan Vanken for this book, he told me that myself and Mae Brussel were two of the reasons that he had moved to the east of the West Coast from the East Coast. Noting on the bio notes here of Jonathan Vankin, it says, Jonathan Vankin is news editor of Metro, an alternative weekly newspaper in San Jose, California. He was a staff writer for Worcester Magazine in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he won journalism awards from the New England Press Association in 1987, 1988, and 1989. He lives in Santa Clara, California. Well, he won a press awards up through 89. That means he moved out here right about the same time as John Judge, which, again, may be a coincidence, but it's interesting that he told me that I was one of the reasons he moved out here along with Mae Brussel. Again, it may have some significance, but I fully acknowledge for the record that it may be a coincidence. God knows there are coincidences in life. But we sure do have a lot of coincidences and a lot of innocent connections vis-a-vis this whole thing. But it may be innocent. Perhaps Vankin doesn't know nothing, and John Judge is just one swell fella, and I acknowledge the possibility for the record. They may both just be honorable men, and speaking strictly personally, I love them both like brothers. That concludes the bulk of the broadcast this evening. I wanted to bring up a comment that was made this past week by Vankin on the radio. He appeared, apparently, I did not hear the program, but he appeared on Peter B. Collins' show on KNBR, and the subject somehow of the Unification Church came up, and also of Paragon House. And Vankin mentioned in response to a listener question asking how come he did not talk about the Unification Church, despite the fact that he spoke about mind control, Vankin said, quote, there are a lot of things, well, I won't quote him exactly, but he indicated that there are a lot of things he didn't write about. He did not say that he wrote about it, and his editor took it out, which raises some interesting questions. I actually would have felt much more at ease about the situation had he said that his editor took it out and he put it in, but he said that apparently he wrote about it, or he neglected to write about it. So, at least according to this one statement, whether or not it was accurate, and it came out of Vankin's mouth, it was not his editor who omitted all of the references to Moon or all of the references that should have existed. Apparently it was he, for whatever reason. Recall that the book itself has extensive discussion of mind control and mind control cults. The Unification Church is by far and away the most notorious of those. There was no reference whatsoever to the Unification Church. In accessing my working hypothesis that Patrick Edward Purdy may have been a mind control job, Vankin did not mention that he belonged to the Moonies, which was a very glaring omission under the circumstances, despite the fact that the broadcast from 10-22-89, which he quoted for the better, the phone-in session of which he quoted for the better part of two pages, did discuss that, despite the fact that the prepared portion of that same broadcast, or I should say the prepared portion of that same broadcast, talked about Purdy and the Moonies. The report on Purdy to the state attorney general talked about Purdy's connection to the Moonies. That is to say, Vankin accessed a Jonestown tape, which contains some discussion of the Moonies and mind control, and two books, Inside the League by John Lee and Scott Anderson, and Spooks by James Hogan, also had extensive discussion of the Unification Church and the Moonies. So again, the question arises, how come no reference to the Moonies and Unification Church in Vankin's book? According to his own comments on KNBR, that was his omission, not his editor, which again is unfortunate. I would have felt much more comfortable had it been his editor, but it also raises some interesting questions. This will go into the record as an addendum to that particular broadcast. As I said, there have been a couple of interesting developments since I did these particular broadcasts. One of the most interesting, and frankly very disturbing, concerns some sabotage of some automobiles. You heard reference at several points in that program to a good, very dear friend of mine who was also my attorney. Within a matter of weeks of this program having been aired, a very large screw was driven into the side of his tire, and in the opinion of the mechanic who oversaw the repairs, or basically to whom he took the car, there was absolutely no way that that could have been an accident. Just as disturbing was the fact that within that same time period, a major bolt was removed from the engine mount of Paul Korntoyer from Archives on Audio's car. No serious accident resulted, but it cost Paul a lot of money to repair that. And once again, the mechanic said that, in his opinion, there is absolutely no way that that could have been an accident.
I note that while, once again, this may be a coincidence, the pattern would appear to be holding true. Recall that when Cayenne moved openly against John, Cayenne Brussel, that is, moved openly against John Judge, her husband received an anti-Semitic death threat. Her husband is Israeli, and his name is Abishai, and he received a phone call, something, something, Abishai, you dirty Jew, you're going to die. And the next day, her car, when she went out to her car the next day, it had been vandalized. Again, there may be no connection between that and her opposition to John Judge. And there may be no connection between the deliberate sabotaging of both my friend and attorney's car and also that of Paul from Archives' car. But, again, we had an awful lot of coincidences here, and it is straining the notion of innocence and coincidence rather far. Another interesting thing concerns the Mike, quote, Smith, unquote. The individual who called up during the original airing of the broadcast concerning the Mae Russell Center was, again, railing on against me and on behalf of John Judge and said that the individual Mike, quote, Smith, unquote, was, in fact, another fellow Mike, who was the individual from the Constitutional Patriots that I saw every place I had seen John Judge for a number of years. And another thing that he mentioned was that there was nothing wrong with the guy. He was perfectly okay, and maybe that's right. I don't know if that is, in fact, the Mike's, quote, Smith, unquote, who lectures on identity Christianity and threatens to blow up buildings in the name of Hitler's last battalion. There's certainly nothing innocent about that sort of thing. But the Mike that I knew did have some sort of run-in with a San Jose police officer, apparently over his unwillingness to have a license plate on his car. And this other Mike, the Mike, quote, Smith, did indeed sue a San Jose police officer, according to the November 24th, 1985 Examiner article that you heard read on the program. I would note that this individual who, again, may have been planting disinformation, but he said that this Mike, quote, Smith, unquote, and himself and some other people had formed a new discussion group up in San Francisco, or not necessarily up in San Francisco, but after a recent talk by Craig Hewlett. The interesting thing is that he mentioned, one of the people he mentioned as being in this group was a Confederate of John Judge's up in San Francisco. In the months since that, since I did these programs, and they were originally aired again in December of 1991, this same individual, this Confederate of John Judge's up in San Francisco, first initial P, has been carrying on a really vicious and frankly self-parodying and self-destructive poison pen campaign, sending information packets, or really disinformation packets, around everybody he knows that I know and everybody that presumably that he knows, accusing me of all sorts of ridiculous things. Perhaps he's trying to get me to file a lawsuit against him, I don't know, but I cannot prove any damage, and in fact, from everybody I've spoken to, it's actually discredited him. But the interesting thing is that this is the same individual who this other person called up during the airing of the Mae Russell Center and showed that the show that you just heard and said that this Mike, quote, Smith, unquote, was in fact the Mike from the Constitutional Patriots that I had seen with John Judge and that there was nothing wrong with him. And he mentioned that this Confederate who has been carrying on this poison pen campaign against yours truly was, in fact, part of the same discussion group, and it's sort of interesting that the individual has been carrying on this campaign since nothing was mentioned about him whatsoever, in that this individual, again, up in San Francisco, first initial P, nothing was mentioned about him during the course of the entire program. Another thing that's disturbing is that among the pieces of disinformation in this particular poison pen campaign are some, frankly, flat-out lies, the nature of which has led a number of observers, including yours truly, to suspect at least the possibility, and I hope I'm wrong, knock on wood, at least the possibility that party or parties unknown may be attempting to set me up for a Danny Casolaro-type, quote, suicide, unquote. There are indications in this poison pen campaign that that is a possibility, and again, I hope I'm wrong. Perhaps I am, but that has been the opinion of a number of different people who have received these packages, including the general manager of KKUP, Al Calame. So once again, knock on wood, I hope I'm wrong, but this would indicate that the claim made by this anonymous caller during the airing of the Mae Russell program, Mae Russell Research Center program that you heard, is factual. I'm not saying absolutely that it is factual, but it certainly points in that direction. Another interesting thing that has happened is that John Judge has been engaged in about the last month or so in a speaking tour up and down the West Coast. That speaking tour was sponsored by Prevailing Winds Research, including a talk in Santa Cruz on the evening of February 28th. When, in the spring of 1990, Cayenne Brussel, May's daughter, called me up and asked if I'd ever heard of Prevailing Winds Research or a fellow named Patrick Forme, I told her that I had not, and as you heard during the broadcast, over a period of time in this line of work, one learns to go on instinct to a certain extent. There are a number of book outfits around the country, most of them quite small. There's Tom Davis Books, there's the Last Hurrah Bookshop in Pennsylvania, the President's Box Bookshop or Book Service in Washington, D.C. I'd never heard of Prevailing Winds Research or this fellow Patrick Forme, but I just told Cayenne, don't give them permission to reprint. She asked my advice, and I said, hold off, at least until we can find out who this is. So Cayenne wrote a letter to the aforementioned Patrick Forme and said, no, I do not give permission for you to reprint May's material. Then, unbeknownst to me, they continue, that is to say Prevailing Winds, continued to pester Cayenne for permission to reprint May's material. And Cayenne asked them, well, are you in any way connected with John Judge? And according to Cayenne, an associate, said, no, we just reprint some of his material like we reprint everybody else's. So Cayenne, unfortunately, then went ahead and gave permission. I was not aware of this, under the assumption that they were being honest. I wish she had told me before she gave permission. I would have said, hold off again. In any event, though, at least according to Cayenne and the account she provided me, she was told, no, there's no connection between Prevailing Winds and John Judge. It's simply that they reprint some of Judge's material just as they reprint other people's material. But there is apparently a very strong connection between Prevailing Winds Research and John Judge. They sponsored a talk that John gave up in Toronto, and they've sponsored his entire California speaking tour. So apparently either Forme or whoever it was from Prevailing Winds who assured Cayenne that there was no connection whatsoever between John Judge and Prevailing Winds Research was being less than candid under the circumstances. I also noted I received some literature from some people who had attended John Judge's recent talk in Santa Cruz, and there was a brochure, a packet by Prevailing Winds Research called Judge for Yourself, and this was a collection of articles and tapes by John Judge, and in the biographical information on page 2, the notes boasted of John's great work in setting up the May Brussel Research Center and mentioned that he and Prevailing Winds were trying to carry on the work of May Brussel and the Prevailing Wind, the May Brussel Research Center. That's not something I personally would be boasting about, but that is most interesting. But on the third to last page, actually the last page of this particular brochure, is an order form for Prevailing Winds Research. As big as life, there was a full-page ad for the May Brussel Reader. And so John is, again, passing himself off as the rightful heir to May's legacy. I had a hunch about that, and that's why I told Cayenne not to give permission. But unfortunately, the pattern of people not respecting my judgment, so to speak, in these matters continues to hold. I tried to warn everybody what I had already seen about John Judge, and unfortunately people did not listen in time. So I can understand the Greek classical tragic figure of Cassandra, who was given the gift of prophecy, but people don't listen, and it's something I've come to appreciate to a greater extent in the years since May's passing. Also, it remains in doubt whether John, I'm not saying in doubt, whether John Judge actually moved to the West Coast or whether he was simply temporarily located in Washington State. I'd heard from a number of people that he was in Washington State, and I dismissed that as their confusion between Washington, D.C., where he has been based for a long time, and Washington State. But I heard from someone who has proved extremely reliable, and at that point I became alarmed. He is still using his Washington, D.C. address, but according to some people now, he is back or perhaps never left permanently Washington, D.C., which is a positive note. I hope he stays there, because all I've ever wanted vis-a-vis John Judge is for him to stay as far away from me as possible. But I note all of these things as developments that have taken place since this program was aired, the sabotaging of my friend and attorney's car, the sabotaging of Paul from Archive's car, this poison pen campaign possibly intimating a, quote, suiciding, unquote, of yours truly being carried on by an associate of judges who was described by this one individual as being in this discussion group with Mike, quote, Smith. And once again, that may be disinformation. I fully acknowledge the possibility for the record. But if I suddenly turn up, quote, suicided, unquote, don't, as Danny Casolaro said, don't believe it. And those are the developments since I last did these programs. And this particular discussion will be entered into the archives as an addendum to the two-part discussion of a bad book. Speaking of books, by the way, and another interesting detail, and I will have this added also to the addendum to the Mae Brussels show. When you heard Ken Ellis from KPFA talking about this fellow Dave, who attended the meeting of the Constitutional Patriots and who was shot dead, that individual was a fellow named Dave Moran, M-O-R-A-N, and there's a whole chapter on him in a very good new book called The Committee of the States. It's about the Aryan Nations. It's subtitled, I've forgotten what its subtitle is, but it's called The Committee of the States, and the author is Sherry Seymour, C-H-E-R-I-S-E-Y-M-O-U-R, and there's a whole chapter about Dave Moran, who was shot to death. He's a member of the Aryan Nations, and that was the Dave that you heard Ken Ellis describe in the program as well.